Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Professor Matthew Frank, director of the William E. and Carol G. Simon Center on Religion and the Constitution at the Witherspoon Institute in Princeton, New Jersey. He is also professor emeritus of political science at Radford University in Virginia, where he taught constitutional law, American politics, and political philosophy. He has appeared before on our podcast talking about the Hosanna Tabor case and happens to be one of the most coherent legal scholars I know, which is why he's back on the program. Matt, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thanks very much, Tony. Great to be here with you.
I should note that we are recording this on February 14th, 2014, so happy Valentine's Day for those of you listening a little bit later. And I should also note that it is 50 degrees and partly sunny here in rural Washington State.
And it's hovering just above freezing here in Princeton, New Jersey, with accumulated snow on the ground over the last 2 weeks of over a foot.
Ah, and that's your local Research on Religion weather report. I have to say that, you know, with that amount of snow, and I had talked to you last night about scheduling this interview, and you said you were digging out another foot of snow on your driveway. And I said, that's great, because you'll have nothing else to do than to be stuck in your office and talk to me about religion and politics stuff.
That's right.
So today, what we are doing is going to have a discussion that will hopefully provide background notes for those of you who are intently watching what is happening to the Hobby Lobby case that is coming before the Supreme Court. And this case has multiple dimensions, including policy implications for the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, and, for our immediate purposes here, religious liberty. Now, I want to begin by noting that we here at Research on Religion do not take any official position on this court case, and that the opinions expressed by our guest and host do not necessarily reflect the policy or opinion of anyone at Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion, the host of our podcast. What we want to do today, though, is merely provide some historical background to this case so that those of you who are watching it in the news can have a broader contextual sense of what is going on. And I should note that Professor Frank has written a couple pieces on this matter that are already published or are about to be published, and we will link to those on our website for our listeners to peruse and get more information about. So let's go ahead and start with a brief background on this Hobby Lobby case before diving deep into the history of religious liberty court cases in America. So tell us how we ended up with a business that sells macrame and scrapbooking products. How did they end up suing the U.S. government, or at least one portion of the U.S. government?
Okay. The story begins with the passage in 2010 of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, popularly known as Obamacare. It's a very long bill, 900-some pages, comprehensively regulating health care, and we're not here to talk about, you know, Obamacare writ large, but one of the significant features of the law is that despite its length and attempt to be comprehensive, it's amazing how often the act delegates authority to cabinet secretaries, in particular to the Secretary of Health and Human Services, to fill out the terms of the law where things are left open-ended or decisions were left undecided by the Congress. And so, for instance, in the provision that gives rise to this controversy, the law says that employers who are required to supply health insurance plans to their employees, and that's anybody who employs over 50 people, 50 or more people, those employers, and even those employing fewer than 50, if they choose to give insurance, anybody providing insurance has to provide what's called preventive care services for free, no deductible, no copay to the employees, but it's all covered under the insurance, 100%.
Wait, preventative?
Preventive services.
Preventative services. That sounds like I should be getting a massage so I can be stress-free when I go into the classroom.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you're a flu shot or something.
Yeah, they're a flu shot. Okay, yeah. I was thinking massages, but okay. That's cool.
So the law said that the meaning of preventive services or you know what fits in that category would be left up to the Secretary of HHS.
Okay, let me stop you and clarify. That was in the law that says you got to provide preventive things for your people that you're insuring.
Right.
And it did say in the law that will be decided by the Secretary of
Health.
Yeah,
right, exactly. Preventive services have to be provided, but what they are would be decided by the Secretary.
Okay.
And so immediately Secretary Sebelius turned to consult with a group of outside experts. They sound very official. It's a very official-sounding name, the Institute of Medicine. The Institute of Medicine is not a government body. It's really kind of hard to say how representative it even is of the medical profession, but in any event, the Institute of Medicine was consulted by Secretary Sebelius. They gave her some recommendations. She accepted those recommendations and acted on them, and she issued a rule, a regulation, or a proposed one from the Department of Health and Human Services. It went public in September of 2011, I think, August or September of 2011. And this proposed rule, acting on the IOM's recommendation, said that the preventive services employers have to provide to their employees in their health insurance plans would necessarily include for female employees and female dependents of any employees, you know, your wife, your kids, if they're covered under your plan, it would include all FDA, that's Food and Drug Administration, all FDA approved pharmaceutical contraception and sterilization services. On the grounds that these are drugs, devices, and services that are important, the government argues, essential to women's reproductive health, or at least making them available for the choice of women is essential to their reproductive health, and that these are properly understood as preventive services. So the birth control pill, intrauterine devices, IUDs, even surgical sterilization apparently would be covered for women under this so-called HHS mandate, as it came to be called.
And I would assume that this also includes the Plan B pill, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because the FDA has decided to classify, along with more familiar contraceptives, birth control pills, a couple of recently invented and approved pharmaceutical products, called one called Plan B, popularly one called Ella, and these are Plan B is called a morning after pill, and Ella is called a week after pill. The idea being that you can have unprotected sexual intercourse, a woman can, and then the day after, or even several days after, in the case of Ella, take a pill that prevents a pregnancy.
Now, let me back up here, because when we're talking about the passage of the Affordable Care Act, I remember, the House debates that were going on at the time, that it was coming down to the wire, a few votes were going to decide this thing. And I remember that there was a gang or a group of conservative Catholic Democrats, led by, I think, by Bart Stupak, who was a congressional representative at the time in Michigan, who said, you know, I don't know about this. I'll vote for it so long as you don't provide any funding for abortion or include that into the bill. Is that what was going on? And how did this HHS mandate affect all that?
There's still a lot of argument about just what the impact is of the legislation on providing abortions as abortions are ordinarily understood, the kind that occur in abortion clinics. I think it's fairly clear that the Obama Democrats, the Democratic Party, would actually like to have abortion fully covered under health plans, certainly under Medicaid. This is largely prevented by a very old but annually renewed provision called the Hyde Amendment. I think the assurances that Bart Stupak and his gang got from the president were not very strong ones. And I think we can kind of separate out the HHS mandate issue. The HHS mandate issue does not touch upon any abortions that require a doctor's active involvement in a surgical procedure or something like that.
But it would seem that Plan B pill and Ella gets
this is where
get fuzzy.
This is where things get dicey, Tony. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Plan B and Ella, although they're approved under the rubric of contraceptives by the Food and Drug Administration, are understood in the scientific literature has been done on their function. They're understood to be what are called abortifacients. That is, they cause a woman's body to expel and thus to kill a very tiny embryonic life. A woman can actually have a living embryo. Fertilization can occur inside her, and then the Plan B pill or the Ella pill will actually cause the termination. Sometimes before implantation in the uterine wall, sometimes after. But this is what the Hobby Lobby owners actually object to. Let me back up a second. So this is the mandate. Lots of people objected to it, and in typical bureaucratic fashion, this is where our bureaucracy does something it should do. They took comment for weeks in the fall of 2011. Secretary Sebelius published the HHS mandate as a proposed regulation, but it didn't go into force right away. There was, as there usually is with these things, a period of public comment in which people could say whether they liked it or not, and then the secretary takes those comments on board, presumably, and does whatever she does. She publishes it, she cancels it, or she modifies it. Well, after all the public comment, which included literally thousands of objections to the HHS mandate from concerned religious people, Secretary Sebelius went ahead and promulgated the rule as official in early 2012. And the objections came down to this: there are many many people concerned about Ella and Plan B in particular, and see the rule therefore as requiring them as employers to provide their employees with a service that offends the moral doctrines of their faith. So here I am, I'm an employer, a woman works for me, and I'm telling her she has a health plan that covers abortifacient drugs. That's as much as me giving my blessing to that act, which my religion teaches me is a grave evil. This is the way people like the Green family, who own Hobby Lobby, reacted. Catholic employers, in particular, reacted even more to the HHS mandate more broadly because it covers contraception, which faithful Catholics, those who follow the teaching of the Catholic Church on contraception, regard as a moral evil. So whether you're a Catholic objecting to the whole HHS mandate, or an evangelical Christian, a Mormon, other faiths as well, objecting to the abortion-causing products that were included in the HHS mandate, we have now, I think, upwards of 90 litigants in various stages of lawsuits, employers suing to be relieved of this mandate, seeking an exemption from it.
Now, I remember all the Catholic bishops coming to the microphone and talking about this, and I also remember a few Catholic institutions, some universities that were very concerned about this as well. But here we have a private business, Hobby Lobby, and you mentioned it was owned by the Green family. At first I thought it was owned by Mr. Lobby, and I was wondering why his mom gave him a name Hobby, but it's the Green family. What's some of the background on Hobby Lobby and how they got connected with this?
Well, Hobby Lobby is an Oklahoma-based family-owned firm. It's not publicly traded on the stock market. It's all privately held ownership of the company by the Greens. But the elder Mr. Green, whose first name escapes me at the moment, founded the company decades ago as a picture frame supplies business or framing business. Literally in the family basement, and it grew into a big arts and crafts store chain, which now has hundreds of stores around the country and employs tens of thousands of people. The Greens are evangelical Christians, Protestant evangelical Christians, who believe strongly enough in guiding their business by the principles of their faith that they're willing to lose millions a year in potential sales by closing the store every Sunday.
Hmm.
Every store, every Hobby Lobby store in the country, like Chick-fil-A, which is also owned by a Christian family, they're closed on Sundays. And if you go to a Hobby Lobby store, there's one recently opened here near Princeton, actually, you go to the store, and right on the door, it'll say, you know, that because we want to respect our employees' faith and their ability to spend time with their families, we close for a day of rest every Sunday. It's right there on the door of the place.
Hmm.
You go in and you find that there's nothing in the store that is of any kind of sexual innuendo nature. There's nothing that promotes drinking. There's Christian music playing on the PA system. They're wonderful stores for people who are involved in this craft stuff. My wife shops there all the time. Your wife would love it I don't know if they have one near you.
Well, I was going to say that we do our craft shopping actually on Sundays. We go to a different store. I think there's Hobby Lobbies in our region, but they're not close to us, and so we go to one that is open on Sunday, and then we usually end up going out for falafel or Heroes or something. It's become a tradition.
Oh, I know. Those errands after church on Sunday are great.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
You can't go to Hobby Lobby, not on Sunday. So the Greens, and it's right, they have a company mission statement that talks about, you know, living their faith and conducting their business according to Christian principles. And so they reacted to the HHS mandate with great alarm because they're pro-life, they're Christian pro-lifers, and they believe it would violate what their faith teaches them about the sanctity of human life to obey, to comply with the HHS mandate. The trouble is that there are penalties attached to non-compliance. I believe that there's a fine calculated at $100 per day per employee.
Hmm.
If you employ tens of thousands of people, this is going to cost you millions of dollars a year. So they're suing. And Hobby Lobby lost in a district court in Oklahoma, but then they won in the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. And the government appealed the case to the Supreme Court. Simultaneously, lots of other lawsuits involving other employers have been going on, and there's a Pennsylvania company, much smaller but big enough to be affected by the mandate, called Conestoga Wood Products. Conestoga Wood Products is a furniture manufacturer, furniture and cabinets, owned and operated by a Mennonite family. And these Mennonites are very faithful Christian pro-lifers as well, for the same reasons as the Green family that own Hobby Lobby. They object to the mandate. They have lost in the lower courts, the highest one so far being the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, federal court in Philadelphia. And so Conestoga Wood Products is appealing. Now, this sets up the kind of situation that the Supreme Court always feels obliged to resolve when you have what's called a circuit conflict on the exact same issue. You've got one circuit court in one part of the country, one appeals court saying A, and another appeals court in another part of the country saying B, coming to opposite outcomes on the exact same legal issue. So it's no surprise at all the Supreme Court has decided to take the consolidated Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood Products cases.
Okay, I want to come back to the consolidated aspect of this and try to figure out why those two companies got picked and others did not, because I, as you mentioned, there's a bunch of other folks that also sued in court about this. But I want to step back a little bit. You mentioned that Hobby Lobby was privately held, so it's not publicly traded on NASDAQ, or it's not a corporate entity, or you know, like say an IBM that's existed for you know several generations. It's held within the family, and I assume that Conestoga Wood Products is as well. Does that have any bearing on the case? If this was, say, IBM with a evangelical Protestant as a CEO, or any other corporation with a CEO, would that business have a different standing than the Hobby Lobby, which is privately held?
Yeah, I think that a good argument can be made that it would be different. One of the issues that is actively being argued over in these cases is whether corporations can claim any religious freedom rights under the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. Both Conestoga Wood Products and Hobby Lobby are corporations; they're incorporated for-profit companies. But it perhaps does make a large difference. I'm not sure the difference should be decisive, but it may make a large difference that these are closely held, private, family companies, not traded openly on the stock market where anybody can buy a share of Hobby Lobby. I've seen some of the briefs, amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs in the Hobby Lobby case, and some people are making this distinction. Yeah, it would be different if it was IBM or General Motors or something like that. It just happened to have a pro-life Christian CEO or majority of its board. But there actually the argument of the Obama administration and its supporters in front of the court briefs is that even this closely held company or these two closely held private companies that aren't traded shouldn't be regarded as the holders of any rights under the First Amendment's free exercise of religion because they're corporations. And the freedom of religion belongs to human persons, not these artificial persons we call corporations.
Okay, we're going to get into the arguments that are going to be made by both sides here in a little bit, but I want to finish off with how Hobby Lobby and, I guess, Conestoga Wood Products were chosen. I don't know very much about Supreme Court law and how these cases get bundled, or if they don't get bundled, is it just they take these two cases look pretty good and we'll set aside all the other cases, or are they putting them together? How was Hobby Lobby and Conestoga chosen and others dealt
with? Well, they just happen to be the first, among the first cases to percolate up to the Supreme Court appeals process around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you might say that they were fruit that ripened at the same time, and they were particularly ripe for the picking because of this circuit conflict I mentioned. Since those cases matured to the level where the parties were capable of appealing to the Supreme Court, some other cases have come through the circuit courts of appeals as well. There's a couple of Catholic families that won a judgment in their favor in November in the Seventh Circuit in Chicago, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So those companies, the parties in those cases will be watching very closely what happens in the Hobby Lobby case, which will pretty much decide their fate. So for the class of employers that we can identify as for-profit corporations objecting to the HHS mandate, the decision of the Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood Products cases, the consolidated decision there, will pretty much settle things without any further need for review of the other similar cases that are coming up through the courts. They just need, you know, one case or one pair of cases in this case that stands for all the others, and those will be settled. There's another category of employers, however, that are still litigating, and that's frankly, religious employers, religious organizations and institutions, too, are affected by this mandate.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask about as well, because these are businesses that might have a religious flavor to them. Their owners have a religious flavor. They close on Sunday, but they're not churches. I'm not going into Hobby Lobby to worship or possibly even to buy Christian things or anything like that. They might sell them. I don't know, but you don't have to buy them.
Right. But, right. No. The purpose of the purpose of Hobby Lobby's existence is to make money in the crafts in the craft supply business.
Yeah.
That's its purpose. And as far as that goes, that can be happily conceded even by anyone who's on their side.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That doesn't foreclose the question whether they have any religious freedom. But yeah, they're a for-profit company involved in selling crafts. Conestoga Wood Products involved in selling furniture. But yeah, there are other institutions. Religious universities.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. When this first came up, the first people to the microphone happened to be Catholic bishops, if I remember correctly, and they were upset about this. And then quickly thereafter, you heard of certain Catholic institutions and other evangelical Protestant institutions saying, hey, we're a religiously based college with a seminary. We teach theology, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And we have standing here in court. Now, are these two things separate? Are they going to be decided
I'm afraid they're going to have to be settled separately.
Okay.
Let me back up for a second. One possible outcome is that the private companies in the Hobby Lobby case win.
Mm-hmm.
And if they do, it's hard to see how anyone else could lose. Because if you think about it, these for-profit corporations, in some respects, have the weakest case. They're the least obviously religious plaintiffs. And so if they win, then the more obviously religious plaintiffs, like Notre Dame University, Belmont Abbey College in North Carolina, the Little Sisters of the Poor,
mm-hmm.
They ought to be winning, hands down. If, on the other hand, Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood Products lose in the Supreme Court, that doesn't mean... and the government wins, that doesn't mean that the government wins the other cases, because they are somewhat different, and many people would say that the claims for religious freedom by the Notre Dames, Belmont Abbeys, and Little Sisters of the Poor are stronger cases for religious freedom. Now, the other reason why the issues are separate is that the Obama administration, did tweak the rule somewhat after its first promulgation. At first, the only exempted employers were churches themselves, actual religious institutions like a parish church or the Mormon church or a synagogue. Frankly, religious institutions actually serving the purposes of worship were the only exempted category of employers in mm-hmm. the original rule. And because that exemption didn't cover nursing homes run by religious organizations like the Little Sisters, universities run by churches like Notre Dame, or hospitals run by the Presbyterians or the Jews, because those employers weren't covered at all in the exemption, it looked like they were subject to the mandate, and their objections were very loud about this. The Obama administration responded with what they called an accommodation. They didn't fold them into the exemption for churches where there's no coverage under the mandate. They said, you get an accommodation. We're going to make your insurance company supply your female employees with the contraception and the abortifacients, but you're not going to have to be involved in that provision yourselves, because it's going to be free to them and free to you. It's like they invented a free lunch. I don't know how they managed it.
Yeah, that doesn't. That sounds like you're doing the same thing that you were doing directly, but just calling it indirect.
Yeah, exactly. And the Little Sisters, for instance, the Little Sisters of the Poor, have objected, saying, look, what you're making us do as a group covered under this accommodation, you're making us sign a form to the government that says, we object to the HHS mandate, that's part one, and part two, we hereby authorize our insurer to supply the stuff we object to. You see how they have an argument that they're still not freed of complicity in it.
Right. It's just
So they have a controversy going on with the government of a slightly different character from companies like Hobby Lobby, which get no exemption and no accommodation whatsoever.
And I can see how this becomes a gray area rather quickly. If you talk about exemptions for churches, well, that's a church, that's a Catholic church. It the parish serves Catholics. Catholics come in for Catholic stuff every Sunday. But then you have the hospitals.
Right.
And if you have a Catholic hospital or even a Catholic university, I know Notre Dame doesn't just allow Catholics to come in. They allow Protestants and atheists and a whole mess of other people. And hospitals cater to people of all religious faiths or people who have no religious faith. And so you could say, well, the hospitals has a religious mission, but it's open to all. And then almost you kind of get close to what Hobby Lobby would be, to the extent that the Green family says, well, you know, doing good business, ethical business, and providing people with God's glory in the craft business is part of our mission, even though we don't require you to be evangelical Protestant to buy macrame products.
Yeah, you know what? This folds into one of the commonest arguments on the side of those who support the mandate, which is that employers who object to the mandate and don't want to supply, as the case may be, birth control pills or abort-efficient drugs, are imposing their religion on their employees. I don't buy that argument for the following reason. And first of all, birth control is relatively inexpensive for most people most of the time, for most women. And prior to the mandate, lots of women bought birth control out of their salaries, out of what they're paid by their employers. They can continue to do that. Nothing Hobby Lobby does, nothing the University of Notre Dame does, would stand between a woman and her choice to use her own resources to buy herself these products. They don't check up. You know, Hobby Lobby does not quiz its employees, have you used an abort-efficient drug, or do you think you ever would? I mean, they don't ask.
Mm-hmm.
They're a Christian employer, but they're an equal opportunity employer, too. University of Notre Dame, equal opportunity university for both employment and for student attendance. Their objection is, you know, now we're being forced to be in the equation of these choices that we can't prevent people from engaging in with their own resources, but that now, thanks to the mandate, involve us, our willful actions, and our resources. And so, really, the strongest argument about an imposition is that the employers are being imposed on by the government, not that the employers are imposing on their employees.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the arguments that's out there, and I want to come back to those arguments in a minute. But Supreme Court cases are not decided simply in a vacuum. They oftentimes are based upon precedent, and there is a broader context of religious liberty cases that are floating out there in the atmosphere that I think justices are going to be pulling from, as well as the litigants here, the plaintiff and the defendants. Give us a brief background of what the relative or relevant case history that would be informing these cases that will be decided.
Okay, I'll try to do the last 50 years in 5 minutes.
Okay. No problem. That's okay. You know, decade a minute. We're good.
Yeah. 51 years ago, the Supreme Court decided a case called Sherbert versus Verner. It was the first time in Supreme Court history that they decided that the Free Exercise of Religion Clause of the First Amendment required government to carve out an exemption from a law that continues to apply to everyone else except the person or group so exempted.
Now, what is this Sherbert versus Verner case about? Sounds like it has something to do with frozen dairy treats.
No, it had to do with a nice lady named Adele Sherbert in South Carolina who lost her job when her employer decided to change her work schedule and make her work on Saturdays. said, you know, Adele, you're going to have to work on Saturdays. But Adele Sherbert said, boss, I can't because I'm a Seventh-day Adventist, and that's my Sabbath, not Sunday, but Saturday. And I'm obliged by my faith to take a day of rest that day. I can work Sunday if you wanted, but I can't work Saturday. And so her employer fired her. And she went to the local unemployment compensation bureau and was actually denied unemployment benefits because they said, you're not a we will give you benefits if you make yourself available for work, but we know that there's available work you could be doing, except it would make you work Saturdays. They basically, the Unemployment Bureau didn't respect her reason for leaving her place of employment.
Yeah, and that's interesting to note that her gripe wasn't necessarily with her employer, although maybe there was a little bit of tension.
Yeah, that's where it started, but it was with the government.
Right, yeah.
She was denied unemployment benefits because she wouldn't make herself available for work that required Saturday work.
Mm-hmm.
So the Supreme Court said, look, you know, the state can have a general rule that you have to make yourself available for work you're qualified to do, or you don't get unemployment compensation. But it can't apply the rule to persons situated this way, whose reason for not being available for work is their religious faith.
Mm-hmm.
So the Supreme Court defended Adele Sherbert's religious freedom, not by striking down the general statute that she was subjected to by South Carolina, but saying the statute stays in place, but you have to make an exception.
Mm-hmm.
So this started the modern regime of exemptions-based jurisprudence in freedom of religion law. And the next big case that came along, kind of similar, was Wisconsin versus Yoder in 1971. This case involved the Amish, specifically the Old Order Amish, the folks who live without electricity and phones and stuff, drive horse-drawn buggies. There's a colony of them in Wisconsin, and they believe that their children, especially, I guess their males, it was a boy in this case, a young boy in the Yoder family, that they should leave school at, I don't know, 12 or 13, I forget exactly what age. It might have been 14. But the state of Wisconsin said that children had to remain in school through their 16th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Yoder family, which withdrew their boy from school before that age so that he could start on living the Amish life and apprenticing to, you know, his father's trade and so on, and learning, you know, becoming more deeply spiritual in the Amish way of life, they were actually fined by the public school authorities in Wisconsin for not sending their boy to school. So they go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court says, look, you can have this rule for the general population that kids stay in school till they're 16, but you got to make an exemption for these religious groups that have a sincere claim that their freedom of religion is at stake in their ability to withdraw their kids from school. So again, an exemption was based. The law stayed in place, but an exemption was carved out.
It seems like we're opening a Pandora's box of exemptions and various rules here. So,
it has that danger. I think as long as exemptions-based jurisprudence is confined to relatively small groups that, that making an exemption for them doesn't punch a gigantic hole in the law, it's a tolerable way to proceed. I don't particularly care for it, and I have an article coming out soon which will argue against the exemptions-based way of doing things. But we'll leave that for another day.
We'll put a link up there for our listeners
this. Yeah, when the article's published, please. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the Supreme Court continued to grant exemptions in a few cases. It was not commonly done. It was still hard to get the exemptions. But in principle, they were available if the claim was strong and the government's case for an exceptionless norm was not terribly strong. So this went on for a while until 1990 when the court decided an Oregon case called Employment Division versus Smith. It was a lot like the Sherbert versus Verner case, in as much as it involved some guys who were denied unemployment benefits after losing their jobs. In their case, they lost their jobs, ironically enough, at a drug rehab clinic, because they were users of an illegal drug. The illegal drug happened to be peyote. But the reason these two guys, Smith and his friend named Black, the reason these guys were users of peyote is that they belong to the Native American Church, which uses peyote sacramentally. Federal law and many state laws actually make an exception to the prohibition on peyote in recognition of this valid sacramental use of the drug. But Oregon at that time did not, and when they lost their jobs and went to the Unemployment Compensation Bureau, they were denied because they'd been let go for breaking the law. They were actually never prosecuted under criminal law for the peyote use, but they couldn't get their unemployment compensation. Mm-hmm. So they go to the Supreme Court. They're expecting to win like Adele Sherbert did, but they lost. Mm-hmm. And the court saw a difference between their case and Sherbert's in as much as they were actually violating, although they were never prosecuted, they were admittedly violating a criminal statute of Oregon. But it seemed that in the Smith case, the court closed the door on the whole exemptions regime, except in, I mean, they didn't overturn any of the precedents like Yoder and Sherbert, but it looked like they were just slamming the door. No more exemptions. The law is the law. If it's a generally applicable law that's neutral and doesn't target anyone's religion, we're just not going to be carving out exemptions like this anymore.
And one can see how this exemptions-based law almost leads to this seemingly arbitrary drawing of lines of what constitutes that exemption versus this exemption.
Well, it does run that risk.
Yeah.
And, you know, long ago in the 19th century, the court said that the law has to apply to everyone, or else everyone who comes forward with a valid claim that his religion is involved and wants an exemption, that person becomes a law unto himself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's intolerable. And that language from the 19th century was actually quoted by Justice Scalia in the Smith case in 1990. But then something unprecedented happened after Smith. A huge interfaith coalition spanning the ideological spectrum from left to right, and including literally every denomination of Christianity, every branch of Judaism, lots of Muslims, you know, the Baha'i, everybody was alarmed at the Smith case, and there was a big push to get Congress to do something about it, and the something was the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993. That law, which restores the legal norm of giving exemptions to otherwise valid, generally applicable, neutral laws, that law is really what's at the center of these HHS mandate cases. Now, they tried to restore the pre-Smith, Sherbert, Yoder style of jurisprudence in RFRA, as it's called, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA. They tried to restore it with respect to all governments, state and federal. 4 years after the law was passed, however, the court struck it down as applied to states and local governments for complicated reasons we can just set aside for today. But the law remains in force for the federal government. So if Congress passes a law and doesn't explicitly say, by the way, this law is not subject to the norms of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the assumption of the courts is that RFRA does apply, that RFRA actually controls acts of Congress and, importantly, controls the regulatory decisions of the executive branch, which is what the HHS mandate is. It's actually a regulatory decision. It's not in the statute itself.
Mm-hmm.
So RFRA is like the first line of defense for Hobby Lobby, Conestoga Wood Products, Notre Dame, the Little Sisters of the Poor. They're all making a statute-based claim under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that you might be able to do this to everyone else who doesn't have a religious conscience about abortion and contraception, but you can't do it to us. We deserve an exemption. If that line of defense fails, they fall back to the Free Exercise Clause directly and make a constitutional argument, but that's much harder, especially since the Smith case.
Let me add one more case to this
mix. Hey, that took me 10 minutes. Sorry.
That's fine. Our listeners are still here. They're a good bunch. But let me go ahead and add one more case to this. This is what we had talked about in our previous podcast interview together, and we'll link back to that one. It's this Hosanna Tabor case, and that seems to fit into this exemptions-based jurisprudence. And what's interesting about that case, and the reason I bring it up is because it might help us foresee what is going on in the minds of the Supreme Court now, is that it was decided 9-0.
That was stunning. That really was stunning. That case came down 2 years ago, I think in January 2012. It involved an evangelical Lutheran church and school that employed a teacher they let go who was classified as what the Lutherans term a called teacher or a ministerial teacher, someone who was called to teaching as a form of religious ministry in the church. And when a dispute about the terms of her dismissal from the school's employment bubbled up through the federal EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and it eventually became litigated with the federal agency on the side of this fired teacher, the issue in the case was, can the federal government enforce its general anti-discrimination laws and regulations against religious institutions when it comes to the employees that the religious institutions think of as ministerial, as involved in the work of the faith? And the 9-0 Supreme Court said, no, you can't. You can't touch those relationships. There's something sacred, you know, and constitutionally sacred about the relationship between a church and its clergy, however that's defined, however clergy is defined. And in this case, you know, a teacher involved in a kind of religious ministry, a vocation to the faith of being a teacher, was considered a minister by the church, and the court accepted that. In fact, you know, both parties accepted that. Even the teacher who was fired said, "Yes, that's me. I was a kind of Lutheran minister in my capacity as a teacher." So she admitted that. The church that fired her admitted that. The court said, "Well, the federal government therefore can't get in the middle between them. There has to be an understanding that our discrimination laws don't reach that employment relationship, because you can imagine." You know, if it had ruled otherwise, you could have the federal government saying, "Hey, you know what? We've just noticed that the Catholic Church has only men in the seminaries training priesthood, and that's gender discrimination."
Yeah.
So you just can't go there. Now, that was such a strong pro-religious freedom ruling that the folks supporting Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood, Little Sisters, all these other objecting employers, they feel pretty good about the Supreme Court's pending decision in these cases.
Now,
the issues are different enough.
Yeah.
It's hard to predict what they'll do in the HHS mandate case.
So the Hosanna Tabor case might not be directly applicable, but it is one of these things of trying to look behind the veil of the Supreme Court and figure out what their mindset is.
It's certainly a straw in the wind that should be paid attention to. There was some really strong language in Hosanna Tabor, which was written by Chief Justice Roberts, about the importance of a First Amendment that protects the institutional integrity of churches. Now, that's probably not going to be very helpful language for an outfit like Hobby Lobby, which isn't a church, but it could be potentially a great help to an employer like the Little Sisters of the Poor or Belmont Abbey College or Wheaton College in Illinois, an evangelical college which is suing over the HHS mandate. They're not churches exactly, but they are religious institutions understood to be organized around faith principles and deserving of some respect for their institutional conscience.
Okay, we're at the point here where I would like you to give a summary of each side's main arguments, what you think that the main arguments of the government will be and of the Hobby Lobby case. Now, you've already given bits and pieces of that sure. as we have gone along, but if you can somehow consolidate that so that our listeners can have an idea of, okay, these are the three arguments or however many for the government in that. And to make this fair, I decided, you know, we won't start with one side or the other. We'll do it at random. And I got a little coin to flip here, and it's going to be, we'll have the government be heads and the Hobby Lobby be tails. And so whoever comes up first, we'll go ahead and do it. So
fair enough.
And it comes up tails. So we have Hobby Lobby, first. What are their main lines of argumentation here?
Okay, their argument, you could sort of move through the case from what lawyers often call threshold questions to more meaty substantive questions. And the first threshold question is whether a corporation has any claim to the exercise of freedom of religion. The claim of the Green family is that their corporation is a kind of extension of themselves and their faith. They're the owners, they're the decision makers, they're the ones who would have to sign the paper that, you know, buys contraception for their female employees and abortifacient drugs and so on. And so the corporate form is no reason to deny them any religious freedom. On the government side, at this threshold level, there is a claim that corporations are simply not the sort of entities that can enjoy any freedom of religion. They're literally incapable of making the claim because corporations can't engage in the exercise of religion. For the government, that comes down to whether corporations are the kind of entities that can worship, that can pray, that can engage in sacraments if that's, you know, part of the faith involved. On the Green side, they say, no, that, you know, religion is a lot more than our worship and our prayer. We don't just live our faith on Sundays. We live it 7 days a week. We live it the 6 days our store is open as well as the seventh when we close. And our moral norms as persons, as faithful Christians, permeate our decisions as the officers of the corporation. So you can't make the corporation violate what we believe. Okay. Next layer of argument is, does the HHS mandate impose what the Religious Freedom Restoration Act refers to as a substantial burden on the exercise of religion? And here, interestingly enough, there's a kind of an argument going on about whether the government's even entitled to make the arguments it makes. But let me start again with the Greens. The Greens say, well, obviously there's a substantial burden on our religious faith in the HHS mandate because it's making us do something that God says we're not supposed to do, right? I mean, that's, how much stronger can you get? And on the other side, the government says, now, wait a minute. God may tell you not to use contraception, or in the case of non-Catholic plaintiffs like the Greens, God may tell you not to use abortifacient drugs or to be involved in abortions, but this case isn't about you. It's about your employees, their choice. The drugs and devices aren't even coming straight from you. They're coming from your insurance company. So your claim even to be involved in the use of abortifacient drugs is too attenuated to be, it's too many steps removed from what's actually happening to constitute a substantial burden. And the rebuttal to that, I think, is that in the, making the argument that I just described, the government's actually doing theology. And there's an old line of, a strong line of precedent going back a long ways in American understanding of religious freedom, that the government's not supposed to ask or answer theological questions, because it's just not the government's business. And it is a kind of a theological question. Does it or does it not make you do something God forbids if we say, you know, provide these services to your employees? That's a question the Greens can answer, but it's hard to see how the government can answer without answering what is a religious question.
Now, if I'm correct, that goes deep back in history all the way to James Madison, right?
It does. Yeah. It does. James Madison, in a famous foundational document of religious freedom in our country called the Memorial and Remonstrance Against Religious Assessments, published in Virginia in 1785 in the midst of a debate over religious freedom in that state, Madison said that the civil magistrate is no competent judge of religious truth. And he started from the premise that each one of us owes our first allegiance to God and to our conscience about what God tells us. And the whole society cannot make us breach the norms that our conscience holds, okay? Everybody could pile on me, and I will still hold fast to what God tells me is right. That's Madison's principle. At least that's we all hope we have the courage to do that, right?
Yeah.
So, if that's true, if it's sort of a foundational norm of religious freedom that the conscience comes first and obedience to God comes first, then it follows, Madison says, that the government, which is an entity we all made with our consent, we brought it into being as our political servant, the government has no business ever, ever telling us to violate our consciences. And that means it has no business even getting itself in the middle of the questions of what our conscience says to us. And this, I think, is what the Obama administration's lawyers have actually done. And a handful of judges in some of the lower court cases have sided with the government here and actually walked right into the theological questions. There's a judge in the Chicago case I mentioned earlier, dissenting judge Roffner of the Seventh Circuit, who said, you know what, the families that own these two Catholic-owned businesses, in this case in the Seventh Circuit, they're not being made to do anything that violates Catholic doctrine on contraception. When I read that, my hair stood on end, because how does the judge get to say what does and does not violate Catholic doctrine? That's for people in the church to decide, maybe ultimately the Pope, but every Catholic for himself, too, but not for judges. So I think the substantial burden is an element of the case that the Hobby Lobby side wins very easily, and then you come to the last part of the government's case, which is
before you go to that last part. Something just popped into my head, and this is going to reveal my ignorance of judicial proceedings, but it's a tactical question. I know the argument about substantial burden is saying that, well, you know, it's the company providing this insurance to the employer, and the company cannot put its moral theology onto its employees. But what if there was an employee at Hobby Lobby that also said, you know what, I don't want this either. So even if you make Hobby Lobby provide this insurance for me, I'm an employee. I'm right there at the ground level where all this stuff rolls down to. I don't want this either. Have they thought about bringing in an employee and saying, it's not just the employer, it's the employee that doesn't work?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is that if you buy that argument, then the law simply, the entire law that the government is trying to support here would collapse, because there's hardly an employer in the country where you couldn't find one person employed there who says, I object.
Yeah.
But, you know, I do think it is a serious concern for parents. Let me sketch a scenario that few people have thought about. But a good friend of mine, who's a family law law professor, pointed out to me. She said, you know, as soon as the government, as soon as employers responding to the government's mandate start to cover these things, they cover not only the female employees, but all the female dependents of employees, the family members. This would include, say, the 16-year-old daughter of an employee at a company who suddenly gets maybe a piece of mail from Humana or Blue Cross Blue Shield or somebody like that saying, Dear Julie, now that you're 16, and we assume you're in a situation where these drugs and devices might be useful to you, it's important for you to know that you're covered for birth control pills. And if that happens, what just happened to parental rights? What just happened to parents' freedom of religion with respect to the upbringing of their children?
Yeah.
So,
I can see that.
There's a lot involved here, and the court case is going to be argued. The oral argument will be March 25th. So,
you said there was one more leg that the government was standing on. I guess we were covering both sides as argument and rebuttal. So we are covering both sides. You said there was one more that the government was standing on.
One more argument, even if the corporations have free exercise rights, and even if the burden is substantial, the government can still win if it can show a compelling interest in having a no-exceptions policy and show, it's sort of a two-parter, and show that the policy as implemented is the least, has the narrowest impact, the least restrictive impact on religious freedom that can reasonably be fashioned in an exceptionless way. Here, I think the government is undone to a certain extent by the fact that there are so many exemptions already. First of all, they recognized their religious freedom concerns when they made the exemption for churches and the so-called accommodation for other religious institutions. So, right off the bat, there's unequal treatment, and for them to come in with a straight face and say they must have a policy with no exceptions looks kind of odd. The other thing is employers fewer than 50 aren't required to have insurance at all for their employees, and there's a whole lot of so-called grandfathered health plans in the country, health plans that were already in place that haven't been renewed or haven't expired and been changed for something new since the law was put into effect. And literally millions of people are in so-called grandfathered plans around the country to which the HHS mandate simply doesn't apply. So when you have actually a legal regime with that many persons unaffected by it already, it becomes a fairly tough argument for the government to make that they must now have, with respect to this limited number of persons affected, a totally exceptionless regime.
Yeah. Well, let me close up here in our final remaining minutes with a what-if question. And again, it's difficult to often speculate on these things of which way the court is going to rule. I know there's a lot of prognosticators out there, but I'm interested in what happens to religious liberty if the government wins or if Hobby Lobby wins. So let's go ahead and start with the government. If the government wins this case, Hobby Lobby is on the losing end of it. What does that say for religious liberty moving forward in the future?
Well, it for one thing, it says, and I've been anything but shy about revealing my own preferences about the outcome, so I'll just say this bluntly. It's bad news if Hobby Lobby loses, because it means that a bad argument about religious freedom has won. And that bad argument is that religion is essentially worship. It's not work in the world. It's not following a vocation in your workaday life 7 days a week. It's just that stuff you do on Sundays in that building with the steeple on it. It's worship, it's prayer, it's private. Don't bring it into the public square. That's the principle that will win if Hobby Lobby loses. We'll be telling people who are in business, who are in the workday world of everyday life, that in that world, their religion is of no account, of no importance, and their religious freedom is just all about that stuff they do. Maybe at home in the evening when they say grace before dinner, and on Saturday in synagogue, and Friday in mosque, and Sunday in church. That's bad news. If On the other hand, Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood Products win. It's a pretty big victory. It's an important one, but it will also, I think, begin to call into question the whole habit we've gotten into in the last half century of thinking of religious freedom as a matter of exemptions from otherwise universal norms of law. Because this is actually what has supporters of the HHS mandate very alarmed. They understand perfectly well that if they lose these cases, huge exemptions that you can drive a Mack truck through will puncture the HHS mandate. Thousands of employers will be coming forward and saying, me too, I get that exemption too, because I'm situated just like Hobby Lobby, just like Conestoga Wood Products. At that point, the law becomes so full of holes, it looks like Swiss cheese, and it looks like it's unsustainable, which is why I've begun to argue that, yeah, maybe we ought to think about arguments for religious freedom that result not in exemptions, but in whole policies being struck down, so that no one is subject to laws like this.
Going back to some standard principles.
Right, yeah. Right.
Well, you have an article that will be coming out making that case. I believe that's coming out in First Things.
That's right, in the March issue of First Things.
And we will link to that as soon as that goes live online, and this will air before that occurs. So I encourage our listeners to come back and visit us again so that they can get to that link by Matthew Frank. As I mentioned before, he happens to be one of the most coherent legal scholars that I know out there, and I want to thank him today for making this complex and convoluted case all the more clear to understand. So, Matthew, thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. Pleasure being here.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.